This is Poetry Off the Shelf. I'm Helena de Groot. Today, mad at the right people. A lot has happened. I don't need to tell you that. Just 2 weeks after a white mob carried Confederate flags into the Capitol, a black woman was sworn in as vice president. It's a lot to process. And grinding my teeth and crying a lot seems to be how I'm handling it. But the Nigerian-American poet and essayist Hafisa Jeter has a different approach. She turns to history, the small kind that comes to her as family lore, and the large, the kind of history that always manages to find her, a queer black woman, child of an immigrant living in America. We talked about her debut collection, An American, and the long roots of our current moment. So here's our conversation, recorded only a few days after the violence in D.C. I'm just wondering, like, when you heard about the news on Wednesday that this violent mob had stormed the Capitol, did you talk to your dad? Did you talk to your sister? Did you talk to anyone in your family? And what were those conversations like?
Well, my sister and her family like recently escaped this country and moved to Gambia. So like the time difference is so different. So I didn't talk to them, and they've lived out of America intentionally for a long time. So she kind of just looks at us and shakes her head. Yeah. And though I like to remind her, this is her country too, and where she absentee cast her ballot. But I mean, I talked to my dad, not that day, but like later on in the week. But I mean, like, what is there to say? I mean, I watch a lot of it kind of play out on Twitter, you know, and there's like, you know, white America is like shocked. And then like, you know, black Twitter is both like simultaneously looking on and just like, this is just like in both disbelief and lack of surprise and like, you know, able to crack jokes, because what we were seeing is the absurdities that like white supremacy makes, you know, like it was literally groups, mobs of white people fighting each other over the story of whiteness, right?
Right.
Like no black people were there, and yet they're still essentially fighting about us, you know? Mm-hmm. And I know it's supposed to be surprising, I guess, but for some people, but this is how white America has acted in front of us historically. That's why the talk exists.
Mm-hmm.
So like that crowd, that mob that looks so terrifying, it's just like, you guys, black people build our homes inside of that, and you make us.
Yeah. Yeah. It is really what you just say about this disconnect between white America being continuously surprised, and then, of course, black America being like, okay, you know, we saw this coming. We warned you.
Yeah. I mean, because I think like white America needs to remember that like, like I'm 36. So that means like most black people, at least my age, were raised by someone who was alive at the same time as an enslaved person.
Hmm.
My grandmother was born in 1918, which means her life overlapped with enslaved people. History is still in the room. And so the violence that they think is in the long past is literally absolutely everywhere, you know?
Yeah, I think that is the thing that struck me most about your collection, An American, is the historical layer of it. Layer is probably not even the right word, because it seems laced through with historical awareness. Even the tiniest little story about, you know, something happening between two family members, it always takes on a historical dimension, maybe not inside that one poem, but maybe in the poem that follows it. And I just want to know where this comes from. Like, is that something that, say, in your family at the dinner table, was this very present in the way that, say, your parents talked about things?
Well, I mean, you know, we didn't really like, we weren't in the family that like, we didn't have a 6 p.m. dinner table situation. But like, you know, my father is a artist, and like when we were living in Akron, my parents had like a black art gallery and frame shop. And like, you know, our social life essentially radiated out from like art, because like my mom ran the art gallery ran like the business side of like my father's art, but she also taught like African dance classes to me and my sister and like a gaggle of her Black American friends' kids. And like we each had to like memorize poems by Black poets like Langston Hughes, Lucille Clifton, June Jordan, and then we had to perform them at Kwanzaa.
Wow.
And so like I went to like a white Catholic all-girls school, and so like my school days and like whatever spilled out from those were really white, but everything that like happened inside of my family life and around that always dealt with history. I mean, it's a difficult question for, I think, like Black people to understand, because like our entire lives are literally written by history, because like all the laws, like redlining, everything that we see now is the fight of history and anti-Blackness and the refusal to see Black people as people. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But, you know, I think my parents were also like super intentional. My dad was a Black artist. He also illustrated children's books growing up. So me and my sister were also the models. And so like, we literally had children's books with ourselves in it, like hanging around.
Wow.
But like, we also had like books with African folk tales. And because like my dad, a lot of his like just like books that we had lying around the house that he would use for paintings were like picture books of the civil rights.
Oh.
I just remember growing up, my picture books were picture books of like Martin Luther King marching and like, you know, like those life photograph books.
Yeah.
Like we just had like dozens and dozens of those types of things, you know? And meanwhile, my dad's upstairs drawing Malcolm X. And so I grew up with like a very large bookshelf of just like Black books, but also a lot of books about communism and Marxism, and a lot of art books. And I think that like the moment you have art in your house, you understand that time is much longer than you think, you know?
That is beautiful.
Yeah. And so I think that like having a mother that was not of this country and having that be like a big part of our lives, like you know, this country you're taught like teaches you to think like that, like we are ground zero. But like the fact that my mother was in the room meant that there was a different history and a different beginning, you know, and her history was actually the start of ours. It's colonialism, you know? Mm-hmm. And so like they were kind of like dealing with two different shadows of empire.
Yeah.
So like, how would you survive a day inside of empire as like the target of empire without understanding like its history?
Yeah.
And then making sure your kids understood it.
Yeah.
I think the easiest way for like white people to understand this, like anybody who has anyone in their life who is a not straight white man has been warned of something in this country. And like that warning has been passed down. Like every woman knows you don't leave your drink unattended in a bar.
Yes.
Right. You know, like that is a historical lesson based on patriarchy and actual violence, you know?
Yeah.
And so no one lives without history. We just often accuse the people we don't want to deal with of politicizing it.
Right. Absolutely.
You know, we also have to remember that like white America has been taught that history is the most terrifying thing that they will ever encounter, and it will ruin them if they look at it, you know?
Yeah.
And yes, history is full with violences, but like Jean Valentine just recently died, right? And interviewed her years ago for this poetry journal that's no longer alive, but like we were talking about poetry, and she said to me that like, poetry had never given her anything she couldn't handle. And I think it's the same thing about history. History never gives you anything that you can't handle. You know what I mean? To know. And actually, once you have it, it like actually makes you feel better.
I agree.
You know?
Yeah.
Like,
however awful.
And so, yeah, however awful. Because it actually, to think the world is mysteriously like this, I actually don't know how people survive that, you know? Because it's like, and that's why like I've never met like a person of color or like a queer person who doesn't know any history who is happy. I feel like that's when you run into like gay Republicans.
Well, there's a poem that I want to get to that for me really exemplifies a lot of what you do in this collection. It's one of the four testimony poems that you wrote for four Black people who've been shot by either police or some white vigilante in the past few years. And the one that I wanted you to read is the one for Tamir Rice.
Sure.
It's on page 52.
Ah, thank you.
And yeah, I wanted to know if there's anything that you want to say before you read that poem about how it came about why you wrote it the way you did, anything that comes to mind.
It's just, you know, you think about like what would, you know, as Black people, we often, you know, we talk about our ancestors, we think about our ancestors, but like we also forget how young some of our ancestors have become. And I think in these COVID times, people are really understanding what it means to die without dignity and to lose people without dignity, that like to not be able to have uncomplicated grief is undignified. You know what I mean? Like, of course all grief is complicated, but like we're nearing like 400,000 deaths of people who did not need to die. Then people cannot grieve with these people. I mean, like there's a lack of dignity to that is so palpable, you know? And like, I think it's just my time to like, try to figure out one, how do you make meaning out of the senselessness, but also like what it means to witness, and like in Black America, testimony is a thing that both damns and saves us. You know, there's like the testimony of like the courts, you know, this place that targets us and over incarcerates us. And then there's like the testimony of a church, you know, which also spills over into the testimony of a community, and how like witnessing and like showing up being a thing, that one of the things that like we do for each other, because like if Black people didn't keep showing up and writing this down, like think about what the record would be. You know what I mean? The testimony is like literally one of the things that like holds white supremacy back, because there's still pockets of people who believe that enslaved people were happy and the master's kind, you know?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay, so I'll read it now. Testimony for Tamir Rice. Mr. President, after they shot me, they tackled my sister. The sound of her knees hitting the sidewalk made my stomach ache. It was a bad pain, like when you love someone and they lie to you, or that time Michaela cried all through science class and wouldn't tell anyone why. This isn't even my first letter to you. In the first one, I told you about my room and my favorite basketball team and asked you to come visit me in Cleveland or send your autograph. In the second one, I thank you for your responsible citizenship. I hope you're proud of me, too. Mom said you made being Black beautiful again, but that was before someone killed Trayvon. After that came a sadness so big it made everyone look the same. It was a long time before we could go outside again. Mr. President, it took one whole day for me to die, and even though I'm 12 and not afraid of the dark, I didn't know there could be so much of it, or so many other boys here.
Thank you.
What I just also couldn't get over is the fact that his sister was there and they tackled her, you know? Yeah. And I think we often forget that, like, they're killing us in front of witnesses, and those witnesses are each other and our families. And like, I think it also speaks to the trauma of girls and women. I think we don't talk about often that like police violence against Black bodies is also a reproductive justice issue, that like your child, the person that comes out of your room, can never be safe in this country.
Yeah, that is something that is really marked in your collection, you know, this sort of recurring theme of the fact that you cannot protect the ones you love. And I want to ask you about this poem, right? Like, it's written as a letter to President Obama, and it gives it an incredibly intimate sound. Like, this isn't even my first letter to you. In the first one, I told you about my room and my favorite basketball team and asked you to come visit me in Cleveland or send your autograph. You get inside the head of, this little boy, you know, excited to have a Black president. And Yeah, I just wonder what makes you choose this size of canvas, you know, if I can use that metaphor. Like, why this intimate? Why do you do that?
Because he was just a kid, you know what I mean? Something that literally every person on this planet has in common. He was a child.
Yeah.
And yet when he died, when he was murdered, I saw something, a newspaper reprinted that Tamir Rice, a 12-year-old man.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
I mean, and it pissed me off. It pissed me off so much. Look at just like the years of his life. You know, like those are spans of time I clearly remember because it's so small, you know?
Yeah.
He was a child and he wanted the things that children want. And he probably liked basketball. And like this idea, like your kid, you don't understand the complexity. You just like, it's amazing to have a black president. You love basketball and you want an autograph, you know? And like,
yeah,
you know, and this idea that like the gap between him and Barack Obama is literally so much white supremacy. There is so much history, even in just like what is between them. And for Barack Obama to be Barack Obama, that involved decisions that have to leave behind the Tamir Rices, you know?
Wait, can you talk about that? I don't think I'm exactly sure what you mean.
I mean, you know, Obama had to be like so careful as he was running for president and became president, like, because you can't be like, this place is racist as hell, you know,
right.
Like this place is killing people.
Yeah.
And there is no way to be president, to lead this country without becoming an agent of anti-blackness. And so what does it mean to lead it? Especially now when you look at the nonsense about like, don't bring Trump up on charges or don't impeach Trump or we need to just like bridge the divide in white supremacy. People are just like, unity bullshit. I mean, people are just like, Democrats don't have a backbone. I'm just like, it's not that Democrats don't have a backbone. It's that like right now, both between Republicans and Democrats, the goal is to not knock white supremacy off kilter too much. Republicans want an extreme version of white supremacy, and Democrats don't want to dismantle it. Mm-hmm. That's why we live in a domesticated version of white supremacy.
Well, so let me ask you this then. Do you think there is an outside to this system of, you know, imperialist white supremacy? Do you think that it is possible for any human being to live a life outside of that?
Absolutely, because most people are forced to. Most people don't get to participate in capitalism in any meaningful or functional way. Most people live on the outskirts of it. And like that is why anti-blackness and violence and erasure against Native people and the erasure of disabled and trans people and queer bodies is so rampant, because we are proof that there is another way, you know? Because like, if we all had access to capitalism, there would not be redlining. There would not be such enormous money fed into keeping us out. We are told that we are part of the system as a way to like make us like desire it, but it's just like, I think more of us live outside capitalism than we think. And like the way that like capitalism functions is it keeps us clawing to get in it because it makes you too busy to do anything else. You know, it's like what Toni Morrison says, like racism is how they distract you from doing your other work.
Yes.
So, yeah, I don't know. I think that capitalism is like a mirage that we've mistaken for like a reality. And it's kind of like this hologram of the people who actually get to access it cast down on us.
I want to connect what you just said to poetry, because you're making it really clear, like the more the system works for you, basically, the less likely that, of course, you'll ever break away from it because the system's working for you, right? The more you are on the outside of it, the more likely that you'll rise up against it.
Yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, yeah. Well, imagine that we extend that to literature, right? It's hard enough to make a living as a fiction writer, but as a poet, it's sort of close to impossible.
Yeah.
And so I'm wondering if, in a way, for you, that makes poetry precious, because it is so squarely outside of the realm of profitability that it is, again, a haven for another way of living.
So there's plenty of money in poetry. It's just not equally distributed. I mean, hence where you are.
Yeah.
Like, you know, so, I mean, poetry is a capitalist system too. And I would say arguably it demonstrates it better than anything because it takes the world of capitalism and takes it down to a sample size we can actually understand, right? There are prizes that go out to a very small percentage. I don't know what it is, like, let's just say 1%. Then there's the group who claw for jobs in academia, which is white mm-hmm. and highly racist. Mm-hmm. So racist. And then there's the people who try to make money off of books, publishing, I think they said 5% of books that came out since 1950, just 5% of fiction published has been written by people of color, right?
Yeah, I saw that. That was insane.
So that's capitalism, right? Yeah. That's because like, capitalism is just based off of race. So like, I think, you know, we have to be careful with the questions like this because like, there's absolutely no part of this country that is not racist. It's like, how could poetry in the language of our colonizers?
That's sort of what my question was before. I agree with you. And that's why I asked you, do you feel like there is an out? Are we all, in everything we do, inextricably a part of this system, no matter how poorly the system treats one, you know?
Well, yeah. I mean, like, we're all complicit. That's like the rub of living in a country. It gives us, you know, more freedoms and more access than so many other places. And so like, it's just like easier to do anything else than care. You know, I am as complicit as many other people, but I also think that like, so like, just to go back to the idea of like, can we survive outside of capitalism? Most mm-hmm. people do through mutual aid. Mutual aid is just something that's come into our lexicon now, but like mutual aid is every single Black community, you know?
Yeah.
Mutual mm-hmm. aid are like the writers who are like on the back end doing what they can to help younger writers, like give them feedback, get ahead, like, you know, undocu poets, that's mutual mm-hmm. aid. You know what I mean? Kaveh Khanna was started by two Black poets and it took forever for them before our institutions decided that this was something they now wanted to put in their grants to. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Kundi Mond mm-hmm. was started by poets of color. Like none of these things that like we like to use to prove to us that poetry is diverse came from our institutions. We broke into our institutions, you know?
I'd like to get back to a poem. It's the one called Alabama Parable on page 41. And yeah, before you start reading, could you just tell me a little bit, you know, this is a story that you've probably known for a really long time that's mm-hmm. traveled in your family. Mm-hmm. And so I want to know, like, what crystallized this story into, you know, you wanting to write a poem about it?
I think Black people, we grow up being told stories, you know, because like, you know, we have a history that is not written down historically.
Yeah.
Our histories have been refused, right? So like, it is part of like our DNA and our culture for oral storytelling. And that also means that like, stories are being repeated constantly, right? And so in each generation's job is to find something different to do with it. And like, I think that we're passing down stories until the person shows up who can put it someplace permanently. My father, as a visual artist, was able to do that in paint and like in art. And like as a writer, I feel obligated to write the story that shows we survived and just to show the image of just like what women had to do to make it, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that like, it is so complicated to have been a Black woman of my grandmother's time, you know, to know how vicious and how violent this country is to everything you love. And to also know that, like, some of the people that hurt you, you must always be asking yourself, like, where is their violence coming from? And just like, you know, my grandmother absorbed as much violence as she could on her behalf, on the behalf of the people in her life that she loved, her children. My grandmother had a fourth grade education, not by choice, but because she had to go literally sharecrop with her own mother. And then she did domestic work, being underpaid, no social security, no retirement, no health insurance. And yet she built a life on that. She like was able to raise children on that. And like me and my sister have like lives she like could not imagine, which I think is part of the dream, you know? Yeah. But my grandmother was like the sweetest woman. Like she was old by the time I came around, you know, obviously she's a grandmother. But like you look at a woman that sweet, you're just like, it's almost so hard to imagine like the strength she would have needed. You can't even guess that someone could be that strong, you know, but also like being strong still doesn't mean that everyone still doesn't get hurt.
Yeah. Yes.
So, okay. So would you like to read it? You said?
I would love that.
Okay. Alabama Parable. My father leans down the barrel of a shotgun house and looks in both directions. At one end, my great-grandfather is leaking like smoke from my aunt's room, where in her body he has left the smell of fire. At the other end, my grandmother, Gussie Mae, a bull reluctantly bound to her matador. It is barely a secret that this man is the one thing all the women in my family have in common. My father calls it a night so dark the dark could have been broken. Teaches me the hardest thing is to be loved by a woman you can't protect. My father looks down the barrel of a shotgun house, sees in my grandmother, hurt like prayer is a kneeling position, sees that fearing the wrath of God can make you name any angry man king. He still hesitates during a storm because once upon a time, thunder meant the Lord was working. Warns his girls to recognize the certain mole that marks men willing to pay for moonshine but never rent. Says to go for the knees, throat, eyes. He moves like his whole life depends on superstition. Sleeps like he's listening for the creaking door, the smoke signals, the witnesses to my aunt's fires. 72 and tired of keeping secrets, every Christmas my father gifts me another, each an heirloom wrapped tightly in his mouth. Lesson one, there's no God in Alabama. Lesson two, where the road forks between faith and survival. Lesson three, no, my grandmother did the best she could. The kill shot, to leave a wounded thing with its heart still beating.
Thank you. Yeah, I'd like to ask you about the role of the father in this poem. The father who, at the beginning of the poem, leans down the barrel of a shotgun house and looks in both directions. Mm-hmm. So the threat is there from the very beginning. Mm-hmm. And then throughout the poem, who, you know, cannot protect the women and his family, mm-hmm. but only can try to protect the women who come after him, you know, trying to warn them and teach them to, as you write, recognize the certain mole that marks men willing to pay for moonshine but never rent, mm-hmm. says to go for the knees, throat, eyes. In what way did your father warn you and your sister?
Again, I think it goes back to stories. Like, these all came through stories. Mm-hmm. Like, my great-grandfather, I'm pretty sure he died before I was born, but like, you know, the line, like, that this man is the one thing all the women in my family have in common, he's still something I have in common with them, you know? And like, my father was like, he was the youngest of three, and so he lived with older sisters and his mother, and like some stepfathers that like went in and out of the house who were also awful and abusive. Mm-hmm. And just that powerlessness, you know? Yeah. It wasn't until my dad's like in his 70s now, and it wasn't until my grandmother was the age that he is now that she told him that her father had raped her, you know? And I just imagine just like being at the end of her life and then like needing to tell that story finally, you know? But like even beyond that, everyone knew he was a violent man, you know? And like my grandmother was named after him and like my middle name is Augustus. And so like I was given her middle name, but she was given the name of like, you know, the person who was her monster, like, but also a man that she loved, you know, those can be the same people. And this, I think it kind of ties into the theater of forgiveness piece that I wrote. Cause like, you know, when I was talking to my father about this, he was just like, you know, we also have to remember that like, even if the physical or the sexual abuse doesn't come to you, it is enough to just be raised surrounded by it. You know, you live both in terror of it happening to you, but also in like a really like fucked up, complicated guilt if it's not, you know?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Some sort of survivor's guilt or something, like why them, not me?
Exactly. Exactly.
I want to talk a little bit about that essay you wrote on Long Reads, Theater of Forgiveness, because it ties into so many of the things that we've talked about, you know, from history to the violence that we carry through history. I'm going to just quickly summarize it so people who haven't read the article have some way of finding their way through what we're about to say.
Sure.
So in your essay, you start with Dylan Roof, who in October of 2018 entered a black church in Charleston, South Carolina during a Bible study class and sat in that church for like an hour with the parishioners and then got up and shot and killed 9 people. And you write that not even 2 days later, some family members of some of the victims were already saying, I forgive you. I forgive you, Dylan Roof, for having murdered my loved one. And this is the sort of the starting scene, you know, of an essay that you write about this theater of forgiveness. So this kind of long history of how, especially through the church, that Black Americans have been taught to immediately jump to forgiveness rather than give their rage space. And you tie that then to all of the things that come out of rage that is not expressed and that comes out in ugly forms, like the abuse that you just talked about earlier. And so, yeah, I'm just trying to figure out what made you write it. What was the spark and what were you trying to figure out? Because like when I read it, it feels like you already knew everything that you were writing. But I know from talking to writers, that's not usually how it goes.
If only. And never would a book get done again. I'd tweet it.
That's great. So can you tell me a little bit about this essay and what you were trying to figure out?
Yeah, so this is a chapter from like a full-length nonfiction project that I just finished. And in this chapter, I was trying to understand Black rage because like I was really thinking about forgiveness because like the personal thread that runs through this is like my relationship with my late Aunt Sarah, my father's second oldest sister, who growing up just hated me for some reason, could never understand it. But like, I mean, she was a person who taught me that like hate had weight and texture and was something that you could feel when you walked in a room, you know? And that first feeling came not from like the white world, it came from someone in my family, you know? And so our parents like sent me and my sister to date in like every Easter vacation. And obviously I hated it. I mean, like it was terrifying because she loved my sister. So it was like extreme swinging poles, right? You know, this was like, you know, years and years. And like finally, you know, one weekend our parents like, you're going to go to Dayton. And I burst into tears. I'm just like, she hates me and my sister. Like an older sister does, she looks up and she goes, yep. I was just like, where have you been?
Exactly. Why did you not defend me before?
Yeah, but like, we're all children. And like, you know, it's just like, we are children inside this, like, you know, confusing type of violence, you know, even if it's emotional. You know, me and my Aunt Sarah had a tense relationship essentially until she died, like, it got a little better. Like, she kind of realized, like, you know, like, she had realized what she had done, but couldn't say anything about it. You know, like, it's hard to confront something like that, you know? And so, like, I was really just trying to understand, like, why she did this to me, you know, and this is hours with my therapist, hours, you know? So like, you know, like, trying to figure out like what could have happened to a woman to make her do this to a child. And then I had to think about her life, like, you know, like her life was my father's life, except she was a Black woman. And I know that, like, you know, without getting into it, like, I know bad things happen to her. I know men hurt her. But, like, as much as, like, what has hurt my father's childhood hurt him, having to see what he has to see, he was seeing a woman he couldn't protect. My aunts were seeing the woman they could be one day. You know what I mean? Yeah. That's different. You know, I think it's just, it's really complicated to see violence as a woman in a way that it's just different. Like, you know, I'm not about like weighing oppressions, but I think it has different qualities, you know?
Yeah, of course.
And for me, it was just like, Black America, we are quick to forgive white America. Mm-hmm. And so I was less interested in, I became less interested in like, making a judgment on the families forgiving Dylann Roof, because I don't know what it is to lose someone in that way. And so, like, I don't know what it does for them.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, I was more interested in the system, essentially the stage that that happened on, you know, and the stage that that happened on is America in an American courtroom. And I also, you know, white America loves it when Black people forgive hate crimes.
Oh, God.
It's super creepy. You know, it's super
really like
creepy.
The sort of inspiration porn kind of thing.
So what did that cost us? And so I started to think, like, with all that was going on in my aunt's life, you know, growing up and into her adulthood, she had to manage her rage. And so maybe I was that cost of how she managed her rage, you know? That's why, like, the Black Lives Matter movement is so important, because it gives us our rage back, you know? Mm-hmm. It shows that rage can be, it's how you understand a line has been crossed. Like, we would never tell our child to not be angry if someone physically assaults them, right?
Yeah.
So I was really more interested in, like, okay, how do I pick up the mantle of her rage, but do something appropriate with it? Because, like, my aunt had every right to be angry at the life this country had gave her and the life that she witnessed the people she loved get.
Yeah.
And so I think, like, you know, that's why the Black Lives Matter movement is so important, because, like, it points our rage in the right direction, you know? And I think that's what, like, our generation is doing, is that, like, actually we have a right to be angry, and it's inhumane to dispossess us of our rage. You know, I mean, think about it, like, as women, how many times, like, after you write an email, you're just like, okay, now I will spend the next 10 minutes removing exclamation marks.
All the sorry to bother you, apologies for this, for that.
Exactly. Yes. That takes longer than writing the email, you know? And it's just like, because, like, we're taught that, like, we need to be super nice, despite the fact that, like, we are getting paid less to write that email than the man next to us, you know? Yeah. And so, because, like, I know that the anger I had at my aunt was not productive. And it was also, it was an anger that had no understanding of history, you know? Uh-huh. And so, like, how do I put history inside of everything I do, including my anger, you know? And, like, that's why, like, this country dismantles, like, history. You know, that's why we don't have civics. That's why no one knows how anything works in this country. Because, like, if you don't know how anything works, the only thing you have to be mad at is either, like, the Black guy or, like, or the immigrant, because they stole your job. You know what I mean? And once you understand history, you become mad at the right people.
I want to go back to the moment that we're in and ask you Is there anything that gives you hope? Or how do you think about hope?
Yeah, I think that, like, this idea that, like, you know, everyone's like, you know, we kind of have started to fetishize the end of the world through Hollywood and everything, the same way we, like, fetishize, like, the war on terror. But, like, yeah. I think, you know, one of the things about being Black is just, like, yes, the end of the world is absolutely coming, but Black people have lived through the end of the world more than once. You know, every day of enslavement was the end of the world. Like, lynching was the end of the world. You know, like I think that people mistake that the end of the world, it just wipes people out. I think the most terrifying thing about the end of the world is that we're often still stuck with each other after, you know, like, and we think about what is happening with climate change. I mean, it just, like, I don't know that, like, something's going to happen and wipe the world out. And it's going to, like, be like I Am Legend. I think that, like, we are going to be stuck with each other for a really, really long time, which makes the need to find a common story so important, you know? And this is what the work of writers is supposed to do and what we try to do. And I think this is also why writers of color, especially poets of color, are so important, because, like, we're literally trying desperately to, like, move towards a common story. And the only way we can have a common story is to discover the individual ones, you know what I mean? And discover the stories of the people who have the least power, you know? Because the people who have the least power can tell you the most about how the world works.
I'm really grateful that you're saying this. I actually had a question about the end times and, you know, living in the in end times. But you, of course, as a Black person, are tracing the end times way before. Like, you know, there was never not an end times.
Yeah. Well, I think that, like, it's like that's like important to point out that, like, white supremacy is part of my life. It's not my life. You know, it takes up a large portion of it. But, like, in my life that my parents created for me, it was Black. Yeah. And, like, the violence that happened came from the outside world, or we understood that it had something to do with it, you know, when it came into our homes. So, like, Blackness was never the site of violence. It was the fortress we built to protect ourselves from it. And so, in terms of, like, you know, end times, like, you know, like, one of my best friends, poet Camille Rankin, she just had a baby earlier. And, like, my sister also just had a baby. And I'm just like, you know, we have these two Black boys in the world. And I'm thinking, regardless of what's going on, they are freer than any generation of Black people ever born. So, like, at the end of the day, like, that's a truth, like, I can't walk away from. And I'm also remembering that the present lacks the imagination for the future, because no one believed that, like, we could dismantle slavery. No one believed that, like, as complicated as, like, marijuana legalization is, no one believed that'd be happening. No one believed, like, even Tupac didn't believe we'd get a Black president, you know what I mean? and so we literally, like, to hope is to acknowledge that we don't have the tools to determine what the future can be, and that, like, to want it is to set it in action. The work that we do is not for us. The life I live is because people before me got this done. And so, like, I am literally repaying my debt. And what Blackness teaches you is that the only way to repay a debt is to give it towards the future, you know? And, like, I think, like, that's the goal. Because it's like, my sister has three Black boys, like, three Muslim Black boys. The oldest one is 10. For me not to go forward, I'd have to look at them and say, by the way, your life is already over. You know, I can't do that. And, like, who am I to do that? Because, like, no one did that to me. And I don't have the right to take away the hope of someone else. And I think art is one way that we hope for each other. Like, when you don't have enough hope, the community has enough hope to carry you through.
Hafisa Jeter is the author of Un-American, which came out from Wesleyan University Press last September and was longlisted for a 2020 Penn Open Book Award. She's working on a full-length nonfiction project, The Black Period. An excerpt, Theater of Forgiveness, is available on Longreads. For her poetry and nonfiction work, she was awarded fellowships from Kaveh Kanem, Vona Voices, Breadloaf, 92Y Women in Power, and she won an Emmy Award from Poets and Writers. Hafisa Jeter serves on the planning committee for the Brooklyn Book Festival and is a literary agent at Janklof and Nesbitt. She lives in Brooklyn with her wife. You can find out more about her work on hafisajeter.com. The music in this episode is by Todd Sikafoos. I'm Helena de Groot, and this was Poetry Off the Shelf. Thank you for listening.